mean, I love the guy dashing out with the sword to protect the woman's honor. And what we're doing on the show is just talking about that in a real world kind of way, because it's creepy and it's problematic. And we always say in the writer's room that romantic comedy behavior in the real world is criminal. But but it's pretty much every book and film you've ever seen, honestly.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, we go to some dark places. The first is a remote farmhouse in Misery, Stephen King's chilling classic about a writer held captive by axe-toting Annie Wilkes. The second is a boarding school with a secret purpose in the dystopian elegy Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. They are the book choices of my guest, Sarah Gamble, the showrunner for the hit Netflix series You, a show that does for handsome, bookish young men what Jaws did for sharks.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is being held in a detention center in Brooklyn after being seized in a U.S. military operation yesterday. He and his wife will face federal drug and weapons charges. What happens next in Venezuela? NPR's Greg Myrie reports President Trump appears less reluctant than in his first term to send in the troops.
He said, quote, "We're not afraid of boots on the ground." And he said that the U.S. can't just leave Venezuela or the country would never recover. And then in the remark that really grabbed everyone's attention, Trump said the U.S. would run Venezuela. And he said he'd do it with people that were with him at the news conference. He was referring to Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth, along with Venezuelans as well.
NPR's Greg Myrie reporting. Hundreds of San Franciscans rallied yesterday afternoon in opposition to the U.S. bombing of Venezuela and the capture of Maduro. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Juan Carlos Lara reports.
Go war on Venezuela!
Richard Becker with the Anti-War Answer Coalition says the Trump administration's attack is a blatant scheme to take natural resources.
They want the wealth of Venezuela. They want its oil. They want its gold. They want its bauxite.
But about 2 miles away, small groups of Venezuelans gathered in an arepa restaurant to celebrate the ousting of Maduro, who they called a corrupt dictator. Ruby Nino, who grew up in Venezuela, says she's optimistic about the country's future without Maduro and hopes the involvement of U.S. officials will help. She says the people have already suffered too much for things to go bad now. For NPR News, I'm Juan Carlos Lara in San Francisco.
British and French warplanes carried out an airstrike in central Syria last night. The British government says it was targeting an underground facility suspected of storing weapons for the Islamic State. NPR's Lauren Frere reports from London.
British Royal Air Force jets have been flying patrols over Syria since the Islamic State's defeat in 2019. Intelligence gleaned from those flyovers apparently revealed what the British military calls a weapons and explosives facility in the mountains north of Palmyra, an ancient city that's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The British military says its Typhoon fighter jets joined French aircraft in this joint operation, dropping guided bombs on the site, which was occupied by ISIS. There was no risk posed to civilians, the military says. Britain and France are both part of a U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS. The U.S. conducted its own airstrikes near Palmyra weeks ago, following an ambush that killed two U.S. soldiers and a civilian interpreter there. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News in Washington. A silent procession was held today at the Swiss ski resort, where 40 people died in a fire early on New Year's Day. Police have now identified 24 of them, but are not providing names. BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports.
There is a mass at St. Christopher's Church this morning. The normal Sunday mass has become a mass for the victims of the tragedy on New Year's Eve here. And people here, of course, gathering to remember the many victims of this horrific fire. And so, of course, for the families who had been hoping against hope that perhaps their relatives, their children in many cases, were in hospital somewhere unidentified yet, they're getting the worst possible news. They're now beginning the grieving process, knowing that their children have in fact died.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford. During his Sunday prayer at St. Peter's Square, Pope Leo said he is following developments in Venezuela with a soul full of concern. Heard here through an interpreter, the Pope said Venezuela's sovereignty should be guaranteed and the welfare of Venezuelans must prevail over all other considerations.
Il bene dell'amato popolo venezuelano.
The good of the beloved Venezuelan people must prevail over any other consideration and lead to overcoming violence and embarking on paths of justice and peace, guaranteeing the sovereignty of the country, ensuring the rule of law enshrined in the Constitution, respecting the human and civil rights of each and every person.
Pope Leo has criticized some of President Trump's policies. Last month, he urged him not to use force to oust Maduro. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
I mean, I love the guy dashing out with the sword to protect the woman's honor. And what we're doing on the show is just talking about that in a real world kind of way, because it's creepy and it's problematic. And we always say in the writer's room that romantic comedy behavior in the real world is criminal. But it's pretty much every book and film you've ever seen, honestly.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello, it's Shelf Life. My guest for this episode is Sarah Gamble, the screenwriter and showrunner for the Netflix hit series You, based on the novels of Caroline Kepnes, in which the romantic hero is not just a pretty face, he's a serial killer as well. You is not the first book that Gamble has turned into darkly entertaining television. She also created The Magicians for the Sci-Fi Channel, based on the best-selling novel by Lev Grossman. And she was a showrunner on Supernatural, a haunting fantasy series which ran for 15 seasons. Gamble has said, "I'm a horror writer in my heart, in that I always like to ask myself what scares me and what scares us universally when I'm approaching a story. To me, there's just about nothing scarier than the truth that we can never really know another person." No surprise, perhaps, that scares abound in the books she has chosen to talk about for Shelf Life: Stephen King's classic nail-biter, Misery, and Kazuo Ishiguro's tender but terrifying Never Let Me Go. Sarah Gamble, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you. That was a lovely introduction.
Sarah, we've got lots to talk about, but having just finished Misery, my first Stephen King novel, I'm tempted to start with the same quote from Nietzsche that King prefaces that novel with: "When you look into the abyss looks into you." Both your book choices are dark and unsettling, not unlike your hit show, You. Is the abyss something you are drawn to look into?
It is. I'm still puzzling out the idea that you had never read a Stephen King book before this. I'm shocked. It's like very difficult to avoid them for one's whole life. So I'm glad I broke you of your streak. But to answer your question, I do find myself drawn to stare into the abyss, for better and for worse. I kind of think of myself as like a crow, you know? People were a little bit freaked out by them because they would just sit on the edge of the battlefield. That's why they were called carrion crows, I think. And they would observe. But then if you've ever watched a crow just in the neighborhood, they're having a good time. They're pretty playful. They're not actually dark creatures. They're just wearing a lot of black and they stare at all the dark stuff. And so I feel like that as a writer.
Does carrion crow Sarah Gamble find that same fascination with Caroline Kepnes's You, which is also, in a sense, a kind of battlefield? There's plenty of bodies anyway.
Yeah, there are. When I talked to her about the book, when we were first adapting it, I was sort of just lavishing her with praise because she had put her finger on this thing that is so true, which is that women, by and large, we walk around terrified for our lives. We often think about how it's not possible to really know another person, never more so than when you're dating. You know, when you're sitting across from somebody you've maybe talked to online for the first time. And she told me that she wanted to jump into that guy's point of view because it felt fun and dark and almost like a relief to her to step away from her own point of view.
I guess for those who haven't seen you, and there can't be many of them, I know this has been a huge success, but we should just describe the narrative. Joe Goldberg, who's played by Penn Badgley, works in a bookstore and spots a customer, Guinevere, soon to be his love interest, leading him to commit terrible things, all in the name of or justified by protecting her best interests. I really liked these kind of literary Easter eggs that you drop through the series. It's wonderful for anybody who loves books, and kind of surprising to find so many literary references in a TV series. Is that part of the pleasure for you? And how much of that comes from you and from your own reading?
It's a huge pleasure of making the show. For all of the writers, we sit in a writer's room all day hammering out these episodes. And sometimes some book or story or poem or something will come to mind in the room and we'll build it into the matrix of the episode. And sometimes they'll go away to write their episode and something will just pop up in Joe's inner monologue. The murder all aside for a second, Joe is frequently the best read person in the room, and he never went to college. He is a completely self-educated guy who learned about books by reading them because he spends all day in a bookstore. And that was exciting to me to write because I think we conflate people who have an elite education with people who really understand, you know, literature, beautiful writing. I don't think that's true in life. And then on the show, we pour all of our best thoughts about books and writers into Joe.
Sarah, your parents were immigrants who met in a refugee camp. What do you know of their story?
It sounds very romantic. When they told it to me, I always was very enchanted by it because they landed in this camp within 4 days of each other. My mom was a very young college student. She had left in the middle of, I think, her first year of college. By the way, this was a refugee camp in Sweden, so I kind of picture an IKEA. I'm told it was very clean and nice. And the idea is that over time, the people who had come to this camp would be relocated to one of several countries, the United States or Israel or Australia. I have family that went to each of those places. And, you know, they became friends. My dad was a little bit older. He was already a doctor. I think he seemed very charming and worldly to her and very intense. He doesn't smile much. It's hard to win his approval. But she was very smart and precocious. And so he did the dishes for her, apparently, when it was her turn. He would do that for her. And he said, you know, don't wait for me, because he had a job in New York City. And he's like, I don't know how it's going to be. I don't know when or if I could ever bring you out there to be with me. So this has been great, but you're young, like live your life. And she waited for him and followed him to New York. After a year, she didn't speak a word of English. She had never been to the United States before. But I think when you're essentially a political refugee, when you grew up in a country where you're an ethnic minority that is oppressed and beaten up and you don't get proper opportunities, I think you don't cage your bets quite so much. You know, there was a certain boldness, I think, that came from her early life experiences. And so my mom just jumped in. And so she's been here ever since. And now she's a psychiatrist with 2 grown children. Wow. It worked out. She married him. She was right to follow him.
Where did they come from originally before arriving in Sweden?
Both were Polish. My dad was born in Moscow, but he spent a lot of his childhood in Poland. He lived in Warsaw and his father and uncle were actually in the film industry earlier in the century. So he had sort of a worldly upbringing, and my mom was in a smaller place and hadn't seen as much of the world and just was smart and very driven. Her whole world, I think, before they met was just about doing really well in school, getting a great job. I think if you had stopped her in the street when she was a teenager and been like, let me tell you what your children are going to be like, I don't think she would have even been able to envision what ended up happening to our family.
You know, it's a real, real story of sort of 20th century immigration. You were born in the Bronx, but grew up in Cincinnati and later in California. How would you characterize your childhood?
It was, in retrospect, very safe. I lived in a neighborhood where kids could just be out in the street playing. We would walk to the park. Of course, this was the time before cell phones were available to keep a constant eye on your children. But this was nothing our parents really had to worry about. There was something sort of idyllic about those years in just in that part of Cincinnati. At the same time, I've always been an intense and sensitive person. That was true when I was a kid, too. I was sort of born angsty to a very angsty father. So things got spicy at home. I mean, it was not always an idyllic situation at home. And I think by the time I was an adolescent and we were moving to California, I felt kind of war-torn myself.
Let's stay with the intense and angsty young Sarah Gamble. I know you write poetry. I think you wrote poetry as a child. Mm-hmm. Was that a response to those conflicted feelings and that angst that you felt?
Yes, very much so. I was textbook. I picked up Sylvia Plath when I was 14 or 15, and it was a revelation to read the way that she was writing about her deepest feelings. It really unlocked something for me as a girl. And even before that, even as a much younger child, I remember discovering writing kind of as a tool. You know, I would be writing just an assignment or in my diary. And for some reason, the act of putting it down on paper in sentences helped me to understand the world a little bit better. I was constantly confused and upset by the way other people behaved, and I just didn't understand it. And something about writing felt like it could help me understand or at least get peace with just the strangeness of humans and the unfairness of the world. And here I am. It just never went away.
Mm. What began as a tool to make sense of your feelings has become a career.
Yep, we monetized it, for better or for worse. This is a reason I still write poetry. This is why I returned to poetry, really, because poetry is a very difficult writing form to monetize. If you're writing poetry, it's because you really want to write poetry, and that is what you get out of writing poetry. Mm. And to me, that is very just generative. It makes me feel like I'm coming back to myself, because on a great week at work, I get to put a lot of things I believe in the mouths of my characters, and I get to blow things up and pull people's guts out and save the day a bunch of times financially as a producer. But it's not always like that. Sometimes I have really long stretches as a professional writer where I really earn my living by doing pretty much nothing but taking notes from many, many interested parties who do not feel that what is on the page is working yet. And, you know, if you do that enough to a piece of writing, you get very, very far away from that feeling. So poetry is my little nights and weekends way of getting back to that original feeling.
Script writing certainly sounds, as from the way you characterized it there, as requiring a thick skin, all those knocks, being told to go back and take something out or add something in. That sounds like a very vulnerable experience, and one where you have to really swallow ego sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, it isn't as though I don't obsessively go over every single word of every poem 1 billion times and then put it away and then pick it up again. I compulsively rewrite everything. But what you learn over years of being a screenwriter is that the goal, more than any line or any character or any one thing inside a project, is to tell the story that's at the core. And you learn that there are many versions of the story that exist in many sizes. There's the $100 million Marvel movie version of it, and then there's the teeny tiny 99 seat theater version of it. And a lot of the job of bringing it to life, really making it shootable, is about toggling between sizes. And a lot of the changes are being made for that reason, always from my perspective, to try to preserve what's at the core of it. But in a way, writing scripts is kind of a long game. People can very adamantly want to see a script go in a certain direction. And the writer often has more power than they think. If you can just enter into the rewriting process, knowing the things that you're going to say one way or another. Part of being a screenwriter is understanding how to get to the note under the note, as we call it. And occasionally to call them back up and say, I can't do this note, and just have that conversation.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest today is the showrunner of You, Sarah Gamble. A new season of You premieres on February the 9th on Netflix. Sarah, you went to college to study acting. When did you realize that you actually wanted to be off-screen writing?
When I needed health insurance, I think. When I left college and saw what the world was like. I had always, much to the just profound irritation of writer friends growing up, I had always said, oh, I'm a writer, but I'll just keep that for myself. We won't, you know, sully it with commerce. It was very naive in retrospect, but I started by writing things to perform. And the more time just in my day that I spent working on all of the million little knots of a story that I'm writing, the more I just felt like myself. There was a calm and a centeredness that started to just spread through my life, which is saying a lot when you're barely out of your teens. I mean, anything that feels like that, you should run towards, I think.
You were on Project Greenlight, which I'm old enough to remember. It was a reality show created by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, based on following contestants through the script writing process to the production process. What was your project?
It was a feature comedy, a very broad comedy that I wrote with Rael Tucker, who is also a TV writer and showrunner now. And it was called Cheeks. And it was essentially an homage to Dog Day Afternoon set in a topless bar.
I'm a big fan of Dog Day Afternoon. I think I need to see Cheeks. Where is that on your production schedule?
Oh my God, I'd love to circle back. And it probably would need a pretty substantial update. A lot has changed since 2003, 2004. But fundamentally, it was cool. You know, robbers came to the strip club and then the strippers and the waitress saved the day.
I do want to talk about the timing of You, which I think premiered in 2018, 2017, just at the moment when the Me Too movement was a major media story. Was that something that was sort of in the air as you were developing You, or was the timing purely accidental?
I don't think I was particularly aware of it. The Harvey Weinstein story broke when we were in post-production for the first episode, but it didn't really register to me that much at the time. I think because though I was really happy when I realized that this was a big conversation, that it was obviously very necessary, and I was hopeful when it started to sort of dominate the news cycle that maybe we would enter a little bit of a different kind of conversation. There was nothing novel about that iteration of the Me Too movement. You know, there was not much that myself and every woman who's very close to me in my life hadn't talked about a million times. I mean, it's why Caroline wrote the book to begin with. It's in 100 ways why I wanted to make the show. And so it just was the kismet of timing that the conversation lined up with the show when the show premiered. So it gave, you know, critics and people who write for these different websites a little hook that I think was helpful for the life of the show. But I could have talked about that when I was 18. I could have talked about that when I was 26. And then I could have talked about it 10 years before I wrote it. It's never not been like that in my lifetime.
This is Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Sarah Gamble, the screenwriter and showrunner. We'll be back after this.
I'm Laura Flanders. Join me Monday evenings at 7 on Radio Catskill for Laura Flanders and Friends. It's the show where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Then stay with us for three more Powerhouse Talk programs back to back. Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk at 7:30, The Janice Adams Show at 8, and La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore at 9. Monday evenings, starting at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm Patricio Roballo, content producer here at Radio Catskill. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. I want to extend our thank you to all our guests who participated in the Local Edition and Radio Catskill. We take pride in our commitment to keeping you informed by the community and engaging with you on the air. From all of us at Radio Catskill, we wish you a safe and festive holiday and Happy New Year.
Listening to Shelf Life, I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the screenwriter, poet, and showrunner Sarah Gamble. We're talking about Stephen King's novel, Misery. Sarah, as I said, cards on the table. I've not read Stephen King before, not for any particular reason. I just never got round to him, I guess. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to find out why he's such a phenomenon. Misery is a brilliant and preposterous book, I have to say. Very camp, often deeply disturbing, especially if, like me, you don't read a lot of horror. In it, Paul Sheldon, a writer of melodramatic historical romance novels, who has recently killed off his popular romantic heroine, Misery Chastain, and completed what he considers his serious book, finds himself a captive of Annie Wilkes. She describes herself as his number one fan, and she is determined to keep him a captive while he resurrects her favorite character, Misery. Sheldon compares himself in the book to Scheherazade, the reader of the tales in the Arabian Nights, spinning his new Misery story, chapters of which we get to read in the book, in order to save his skin and see another dawn. Sarah, Stephen King has written something like 64 novels and hundreds of short stories. What is it about this one, of all of those books, that spoke to you?
I have always said, just offhandedly, that it's my favorite, although I hadn't read it in probably decades. I revisited it very recently, and I loved it even more, to be honest. I feel like people, as popular as he is, they sort of underestimate him in certain ways. So I'm a champion of his work as important, and that people can be kind of snobs about stuff that's very entertaining, but is actually also, I think, really influential in a lot of ways. So,
in the pilot episode of You, there's actually a nod to Stephen King I was delighted to spot, when Joe Goldberg sees Guinevere browsing the shelves and he thinks to himself that she is too, quote, sun-kissed to be looking for Stephen King. You were obviously not too sun-kissed for Stephen King. What of his other books did you perhaps think about before alighting on Misery?
I think I've read probably most of his books. I started reading him early in my teens, and then there was a long space of time where I didn't. And then when the pandemic hit in 2020 and I was taking very long walks for my own sanity, I started to download and just listen to his books. It was sort of story time. I ended up listening to 16 or 17 of his books in a row. I wasn't even really thinking about it. But as somebody who really loves those kinds of stories, loves to see how the mechanics of a great scare or a great piece of psychological horror or thriller works, it was kind of a remarkable experience for my brain to just go from one to the next, to the next, to the next. But to answer your question, it was the only choice for me. I mean, it's the one that popped to mind immediately. I think it is, I agree it's preposterous in certain ways. I mean, it is very, you know, it's like swinging a big red axe, that story. But it's also incredibly simple. And it is what TV writers call a bottle episode. I think most people probably know what that is right now, but briefly, a bottle, it's called a bottle episode, like a ship in a bottle. When you inevitably go over budget at some point in your season and you have to wrestle back some of the money that you spent because all the money people are calling you every day, one of the things you can offer up is that you'll write a bottle episode, which simply means more or less that you will write as much of the script as possible, ideally all of it, on standing sets that have already been built. So you don't have to pay for them. You don't have to pay for trucks to move anybody anywhere. And you'll primarily use actors that you already have under contract. So it becomes this very small, efficient machine. And they're really fun, actually, to figure out because you're so constrained. I really like that challenge. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite episodes of all kinds of shows are bottle episodes. And Misery is a book that gets brought up all the time because it couldn't be simpler. It's four walls. This guy cannot get out of bed. He is in so much pain, he can't even lean over and pick something up off the floor. And this woman walks in and out. His fate is in her hands. She's not a monster. She's not going to turn into a demon with snakes for hair. She is a human person. And over the course of the story, you get to know the inner workings of both of them. And by and large, it takes place entirely in that room. Mm. And that is very exciting and impressive to me.
Yeah, it's interesting you say she's not a monster because there are obviously monstrous things that she's done and that reveals itself through the course of the book. But what I found kind of horrifying about Misery is not simply the scenes of violence, and there are several notable scenes of violence in this, but actually the scenes often that weren't violent at all, but were extremely visceral. There's a description, for example, of Annie Wilkes giving Paul Sheldon mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and he can smell her breath going in and out of him. And the description is a dreadful stench of vanilla cookies and chocolate ice cream and chicken gravy and peanut butter fudge. And I have to say that was as horrifying to me in its way as Annie bringing down an axe on poor Sheldon's left foot. And, you know, I broadly don't like to give spoilers, but I think in this case, since the movie is so well known, we can give a few spoilers. There's another line where Paul describes seeing in the face of Annie Wilkes the black nothing of a crevasse folded into an alpine meadow, a blackness where no flowers grew and into which the drop might be long. It was the face of a woman who has come momentarily untethered from all the vital positions and landmarks of her life. I mean, that's such a brilliant description of a kind of mania or madness, really. Beautiful. And yet so forbidding at the same time. The book is full of moments like that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. This is my favorite tension, really, in stories, dark stories like this, is that we're plumbing the monstrousness of people. And if you happen to have a monster in the story, my preference is to have the monster, that the literal monster, be there so you can really dig into the humanness of the other, right? I love just sort of getting a spoon and digging deeply into what that line is. We love to ask questions when there's a tragedy or a horror, when a man kills his wife or his entire family, or when somebody gets cancer at an incredibly young age. And what we're trying to do is find the detail in the story that means it could never happen to us, or we could never perpetrate that. Mm. And I just don't believe that these differences are that big. I mean, Annie Wilkes is pretty profoundly mentally ill in this story and vividly dissociating and manic, and she goes through terrible depression and horrible mania. You get the whole spectrum of her mental illness. But, you know, our brain chemistry can be tipped easier than a lot of people think, actually. So that's the thrill of these stories to me, and it's also why they really scare me. I do really feel like I'm making myself walk up to something really terrifying and look right at it, which is that I don't think I'm that different than the horrible people that I'm writing about, you know? But I just don't think it's that far away from just a regular person.
Did you wonder when you were reading this book or rereading it, the extent to which their relationship becomes a little symbiotic at certain times, where Paul needs Annie? I mean, he needs her for his drugs, for the painkillers. He needs her for food and water. She needs him to finish the novel. But in a way, he also needs her as a kind of muse. He ends up writing what he considers to be his best work. And Annie Wilkes is a part of that process. She gives him ideas that he actually ends up using. So I thought there was a lot of things going on here about the creative process. I think I'll probably be sort of figuring out some of that for a while. But I felt there were a lot of games being played here about the process of writing, about the relationship between a creator and their audience, and also about the way in which these two people were, in a sense, each other's nemesis, but also needed one another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's always a little bit dangerous to be like, well, look at the writer, look at the author. But I do find it fascinating that one of the things that Paul Sheldon is wrestling with the most is that he wants to kill and get away from his most popular creation because he thinks it's beneath him. He judges romance novels. He thinks it's off. He thinks Misery is just an albatross around his neck, and he was happy to kill her and move on and win his prestigious awards and be seen as good as he thought he was. I think in the movie that he does write his prestigious novel, but in the book, he finally realizes he's the writer that he is, and he might as well embrace that. And there are times when she's demanding, holding him hostage and demanding that he bring Misery back from the dead and do it in a way that is fair, that's believable, that's not just there was a parachute under the seat. It's funny because the writer is a writer. He can't resist. He really wants to write it. He's kind of on a roll. He's impressed with himself about how much he's writing every day now that he finally has no distractions. And, you know, the parameters of the story are so clear. And in a really sick way, he's sort of enjoying it while he's writing Misery's Return.
Sarah, we have a short excerpt from the audio edition of Misery by Stephen King. Here it is.
She reappeared promptly when the clock in the other room struck 8, with 2 capsules and a glass of water. He hoisted himself eagerly on his elbows as she sat on the bed.
"I finally got your new book 2 days ago," she told him.
Ice tinkled in the glass. It was a maddening sound.
"Misery's Child. I love it. It's as good as all the rest. Better. The best."
"Thank you," he managed. He could feel the sweat standing out on his forehead. "Please. My legs. Very painful."
"I knew she would marry Ian," she said, smiling dreamily. "And I believe Jeffrey and Ian will become friends again, eventually."
"Do they?"
But immediately she said, "No, don't tell. I want to find out for myself. I'm making it last. It always seems so long before there's another one."
The pain throbbed in his legs and made a deep steel circlet around his crotch. He had touched himself down there and he thought his pelvis was intact, but it felt twisted and weird. Below his knees, it felt as if nothing was intact. He didn't want to look. He could see the twisted, lumpy shapes outlined in the bedclothes, and that was enough.
"Please, Miss Wilkes, the pain. Call me Annie. All my friends do."
She gave him the glass. It was cool and beaded with moisture. She kept the capsules. The capsules in her hand were the tide. She was the moon, and she had brought the tide which would cover the pilings. She brought them toward his mouth, which he immediately dropped open, and then she withdrew them.
"I took the liberty of looking in your little bag. You don't mind, do you?"
"No, no, of course not. Oh, the medicine." The beads of sweat on his forehead felt alternately hot and cold. Was he going to scream? He thought perhaps he was.
"I see there is a manuscript in there," she said.
She held the capsules in her right hand, which she now slowly tilted. They fell into her left hand. His eyes followed them.
"It's called Fast Cars. Not a misery novel, I know that. She looked at him with faint disapproval, but as before, it was mixed with love. It was a maternal look. No cars in the 19th century, fast or otherwise. She tittered at the small joke. I also took the liberty of glancing through it. You don't mind, do you? Please, he moaned. No, but please. Her left hand tilted. The capsules rolled, hesitated, and then fell back into her right hand with a minute clicking sound. And if I read it? You wouldn't mind if I read it? No. His bones were shattered, his legs filled with festering shards of broken glass. No. He made something he hoped was a smile. No, of course not. Because I would never presume to do such a thing without your permission, she said earnestly. I respect you too much. In fact, Paul, I love you. She crimsoned suddenly and alarmingly. One of the capsules dropped from her hand to the coverlet. Paul snatched at it, but she was quicker. He moaned, but she did not notice. After grabbing the capsule, she went vague again, looking toward the window. Your mind, she said. Your creativity. That is all I meant. In desperation, because it was the only thing he could think of, he said, I know. You're my number one fan.
That was an excerpt from Misery by Stephen King. The narrator was Lindsay Krause, and the book is published by Scribner. I'm Aaron Hicklin. You're listening to Shelf Life, and my guest is the showrunner, Sarah Gamble. Her hit TV show, You, returns to Netflix on February 9th. Sarah, she's an incredibly camp figure, Annie Wilkes, as awful mm-hmm. and horrible as she is. Her expressions throughout the book, Dirty Bird, Cock-a-doodie, Yes-siree Bob, her tendency to often talk about herself in the third person. When she thinks that the new Misery book is finished, she insists on presenting Paul with a bowl of caviar and a bottle of very expensive champagne. I just thought all those scenes were funny, and I wasn't expecting quite so much humor in what is also a very dark book.
She doesn't like cursing. She doesn't like fornication. She's very buttoned up. She just happens to also have a long history of serial killing.
Yeah, the book, the masterpiece that he's written is full of curse words, and she forces him to burn it in a grill that she brings into the room. It's an incredibly painful and traumatic scene because you really are there in Paul's position as this work, this magnum opus that he's worked on for so long, is burned. Again, there's so much here about a writer's worst fears, losing that one manuscript that they have, not being taken seriously. All of that is something that your mother, the psychiatrist, might have a lot to say about.
There is something very strange about being a writer. There's a compulsion, I think, at the core of writing for probably most serious writers. I don't think that a lot of people who really devote their lives to writing feel like they picked it. It's almost like not a choice, but it is sort of a weird thing to spend all your time doing. There's a lot of stuff that will save more lives, will grow more crops. I remember early in my career, I was working on Supernatural, and it was the end of a season, and Eric Kripke, the creator of that show, came around with a box of DVDs, and he handed me the DVD of that season. And he said, there you go, that's all of your work. And I held this little plastic box in my hand. I just felt so silly in that moment because I really worked hard, and you just hold it in your hand. And I think that's true of every book. It's like you hope people think it's precious, right? Paul Sheldon certainly does. He hopes that people will hold it in very high regard and that they'll hold him in very high regard. And he gets that just from the Misery book and this crazy lady, I guess. But I mean, yeah, you spent 2 years writing that pile of papers. You were dumb enough not to make any copies. And it all went up in 45 seconds. I think Stephen King is being kind of hard on all of us there.
As you say, he does conclude belatedly and eventually that perhaps his Misery novel is the best thing he's written, and there's no shame in that. So it is a sort of come to Jesus sort of moment of realizing that the entertainment is as valuable, if not more so, than the great American novel. The book includes lots of sections of the new Misery novel. So you break away from this claustrophobic space of the bedroom in which poor Sheldon is imprisoned, and you go into this romantic historical saga in which Misery has been buried alive, covered in a cloak of bees. But what did you feel about that juxtaposition of the book within the book? How did that work for you?
I find it pleasurable. It's incredibly florid, purple writing on purpose. And it does, I think, ventilate the story that is so claustrophobic in a way that's kind of enjoyable. And then also, I think the entire book is about what happens to Paul Sheldon in that room. It's just a magnifying glass on what's happening to his psyche, which I think, by the way, in a sentence is probably why I love the book, because that's the entire exercise, is you put this character in a vice and then you burrow as deep into his psyche as you can.
Now, King has gone on record as saying he doesn't consider himself a horror writer. Do you think that is part of the problem, the way we pigeonhole and categorize writers and sort of dismiss often genre fiction?
We're a desperately snobby culture, and I might be less afraid of throwing terms like horror writer around because I think I'm fundamentally pigeonholed because I'm a woman. It starts there. And, you know, there's this thirst to prove that you are smart and deep and good based on what you're reading. It plays out certainly in literature. It plays out very much in film and television. I find it just amusing when people try to kind of parse what kind of TV it is, whether it's important TV or guilty pleasure TV. Something I really enjoy doing is using the forms and the structures of a certain type of story to subverting them, essentially. And You was like a candy store for me, because there's so much to subvert about the psychological thriller and about the sort of lifetime romance that it is. But people also kind of look at it and take it at face value. So I have accepted that people will look at the poster and think what they will think. And if they come deep enough into the story, they might see what we're doing.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Often I think that if so-called chick lit books didn't have such tediously specific covers designed to appeal to an idea of a certain reader, usually female, and if horror fiction didn't have a certain kind of cover that's designed to appeal to what I consider a sort of adolescent male, essentially, I might be more inclined to pick it up. You started on Lifetime before the show moved to Netflix, and I can't help wondering how that changed the perception of the show for viewers.
I think it was an almost perfect case study, actually, because hearing that it's on a network that is television for women was just the barrier to entry for so many people, male and female. And then as soon as they dropped it on Netflix, it actually just hit so many different things that people like. It ended up in a lot of people's recommendations, and then immediately it overperformed among every male demographic. It was a complete illusion. I mean, it was fun to write for Lifetime because we were sending up exactly the kind of love stories that they were telling. And they were a great partner in that they were very on board with what we were doing. For what it's worth, I felt the same thing making The Magicians. Being on a network called Sci-Fi was also a self-limiting kind of thing. I think it's very easy to make things too niche. And I find that so frustrating when I go just into a bookstore and want to pick some books. The covers don't have any faith in me at all, you know, and they're just not giving me a chance to get outside of my box. I don't want to be catered to. I want to discover points of view that I've never read before.
Mm. You were listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the screenwriter, poet, and showrunner, Sarah Gamble. Sarah, unlike Stephen King, Kazuo Ishiguro is not a fast writer. He's written, I think, 8 novels to Stephen King's 64 novels. But Never Let Me Go, published in 2005, has all the chills of a Stephen King novel, but with a very different kind of plot, one that I found I had to figure out as I went along, which was a big part of the appeal and the charm of it. We were introduced to a group of teenagers at a boarding school. They seem like any other privileged kids. They play sports, they take art classes, they flirt. Their teachers keep telling them that they're special and that they have an important role to play in later life. And then the rather horrible secret slowly emerges. I'm going to try and avoid plot spoilers in this one. But do you recall the moment you understood why the teachers at the school called their students special?
I first read it not long after it came out, and I recall knowing fairly shortly before he actually reveals it. There's a moment in the story where it's pretty spelled out for the protagonist. There's a lot of playing with expectation about what is really going on, because there's a lot of you're special, you're different, you can't do this, this is different about you. Both things that sound great and then things that sound really restrictive. And it's eerie how sheltered these children are. So you're making all of these guesses. I think it's part of the just varsity level trick that he's pulling. I don't know. Trick actually is a word that I think cheapens how just gorgeous the book is and how I think sincere his mission was when he wrote it. But he screws with you a bit in the first third.
Yeah, I said in my short intro there that it had all the chills of a Stephen King novel, but it's also deeply soulful. It's a romantic novel. There's actually a romance at the heart of it, and that is heartbreaking, ultimately, in this book. It reduced me to tears.
Me too. I reread it in advance of this conversation. I also cried at the end, the closer I got to the end, the more I found myself getting kind of choked up. And one of the things I thought was very notable about how the book is written is that he brings a lot of discipline to the point of view that he's using. This is a memory story that's being told by Kathy. Every word of the novel is a word she would use. And a lot of what we're figuring out, despite the fact that she doesn't understand it. But a lot of the point of the book is for you to get so deep inside of her that you can actually make kind of a spiritual judgment about her. And so it's not a surprise. As soon as you really live with people, I think you kind of fall in love with them. Hitchcock said that if you will root for whoever is on the screen, doesn't matter if they're good, if they're bad, when we watch them, we feel like we're them. So if you very delicately and very precisely render a portrait of a person, then I think the romance just comes to you, you know?
And remind us who Kathy is, described as she is presented in the book.
So Kathy is one of the children at the special school called Hailsham, which is some type of boarding school in the countryside of England. The story of the book is mostly about her and two friends, a boy named Tommy and a girl named Ruth. And none of them is extraordinary. Like, none of them makes you feel like you're at Professor X's school for mutant geniuses or anything. You know, they're pretty in the middle of any bell curve you could think of. Each of them has their own little thing that makes them special. And in Kathy's case, she has an incredibly high emotional IQ. The thing that she does in any room she goes into is that she really notices how everybody is feeling. And she can clock the most minute changes in the state of her friends. So she is the perfect person to report on what happened. The book feels like she's telling it. She starts by telling us she's a carer. And it sounds like maybe that's some kind of nurse, and that she's caring for somebody who was at another school that wasn't Hailsham. So frequently she's very conversational. Like, I don't know how it was where you were, but at Hailsham, we did all these things. And she's just at a place in her life where she's thinking a lot about that time.
Ishiguro is really good on things like class, isn't he? Obviously, he did that extremely well in Remains of the Day, perhaps his best-known novel, which was also made into a great movie. He's a Japanese-English writer. Is this a case, do you think, of the outsider being able to see people better than they can often see themselves?
That's my suspicion. I don't know what he says about it, but you know, that's a fundamental enough difference, being Japanese in an English society. It's a fundamental enough difference to feel different everywhere. I feel different everywhere. And just looking at me, I pass in most rooms in the United States, but I came from two cultures at once, right? My parents were foreign, and then I was an American kid on the playground, but I didn't quite fit in the culture of my home, and I didn't quite fit in the culture of the playground. And so I did become an observer of both. And it was only very, very recently, actually, in a sort of therapy-like conversation I was having with a friend, that I realized I really never feel like I belong in any group of more than two people. When I first said it, I was sad. And then I was like, or maybe that's just what being a writer is. It's fine.
Both the books you've chosen have been made into movies. It's commonly held that something is lost in translation when books become movies, true or false. How well do you think these two books have managed that leap?
I rewatched Misery last weekend, and I haven't seen Never Let Me Go in many years, so I can't speak as concisely about that. But Misery was really fun. It really feels like a 90s movie. But William Goldman wrote the screenplay. I was interested in the changes that he made. And I think, you know, when you're reading a book that is, as you say, at times kind of almost broad and campy because it's just so gory. I mean, limbs are getting chopped off. Well, then great, let's see it. Because the point is to gross you out and spatter you with blood and to very viscerally feel the scream of a guy who's being hobbled. Never Let Me Go is much more difficult, I think. Not that, by the way, any adaptation is easy. All of them will make you pull your hair out. But there's a floating above it all kind of quality to Never Let Me Go. He's very careful not to describe the more just invasive aspects of what that story is. There's almost like a bloodless quality to how she's experiencing everything that's happening around her. And I think even more challenging, the point of the book is not for her to change the culture. She's never for a second portrayed as somebody who even has the kind of consciousness that it would be possible to challenge her lot in life. It's very much observing how everyone in the story accepts where they are and is doing their part to uphold a system that's very unfair. And I think fundamentally those are more challenging stories to adapt because they are depressing. And because the main character is not a hero who's going to crawl through the, you know, air ducts and stab people in the neck to save the day. I always say when you have a novel and it's very dark and dystopian and concerned with aspects of mortality, make a TV series out of it because you can spend longer with it and nobody is expecting you to have the hero win in 90 minutes.
Sarah Gamble, thank you so much for joining me on Shelf Life. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. This was great.
We've been talking about Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro, published by Penguin, and Misery by Stephen King, published by Scribner. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Gram Books in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, as well as our own website, shelflifepodcast.net, with guests like Alan Cumming, John Waters, and Joyce Maynard. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It will help others find our show.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
Sullivan County has two warming centers that are open to all every night this winter. The Liberty Shelter is located at the United Methodist Church on North Main Street, and the Monticello Shelter is located at St. John's Episcopal Church on St. John Street. These shelters are open for anyone from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. More information at sullivanny.us. And keep listening for winter weather updates on Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.